Blog Talk Radio.
Talking about today on WAMS Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Hi, I'm Burke Allen in our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., and the auto industry in the U.S. and now worldwide in a free-fall tumble as we broadcast this show live on Friday, March the 6th. General Motors shares hovering around record lows. At one point yesterday, they were down just over a dollar a share before rebounding slightly. What will happen if the U.S. auto industry goes belly up? Are we in danger of that kind of meltdown in Motor City? To help us make sense of it all, Kevin Kimbrough joins us today. Kevin, an industry expert, he has operated in his lifetime Ford, Lincoln, Mercury, Chevy, Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep, Toyota, Nissan, Kia, and Daewoo dealerships. As an executive or an owner, spent most of his career in and around the Indianapolis area. Kevin, a recipient of the Indianapolis Business Journal's 40 Under 40 Award and also an Achievement in Business Award from the Center for Leadership Development, and you can visit him online at kevinkimbrough.com. Hi, Kevin, and welcome to WAMS.
Hi there, Burke.
Now, it looks as if things are going to get a lot worse before they get better, and the latest news on General Motors is that their auditors have released a statement saying that there's a really good chance that under their current structure, General Motors, one of the the legendary companies in American history, may go away. And they're not alone. You know, also in that world, companies like General Electric, who have seen their shares erode completely. So it's not just an automotive issue, but certainly the car business is in a world of hurt. Is it way too little, way too late to save the U.S. auto industry?
Well, you know, it's as the industry is just extremely complex, and it's looking dire for the industry, no question about it. But I think that there is a certain amount of American fortitude that can take place, but quite surely the industry is going to be a lot less expansive than what it once was.
Kevin, if General Motors and Chrysler and maybe even Ford go under, what kind of effect would that have on the economy here in the U.S. As well as worldwide? Walk us through what a world would look like without General Motors.
Well, I think what ends up happening is that, as I explained earlier, that it's a complex manufacturing process. There's a lot of people involved in the industry, whether it's purchasing, it's testing, the employees, the quality control, and the folks that distribute the vehicle. So you have all these constituents that will be involved in this whole breakdown of the industry, and those industries would probably seek to exist, at least a lot of them, as a going concern in the future. So it's dire, and it needs to be addressed. However, with anything, I think these things can be worked out. Right now, the industry is a global industry that much more than what it once was in years past, say, for instance, in the 70s. And that's really when the breakdown really started to happen, as I examine it, particularly late 70s, early 80s, when there was a lot of outsourcing within the American manufacturers.
And Kevin Kimbrough is our guest, by the way, if you'd like to talk with him. It's a free call in the New York City metropolitan area, 718-506-1944, 718-506-1944, or you can join us in the live chat session on the WAMS website. Kevin, you say this all began, this is not a recent thing that just happened with the crashing of the U.S. economy in September of last year. This actually started in the late 70s. How so?
Well, when you look at the economic model for the industry, primarily the American automobile industry was comprised of plants in communities across this nation, and those communities were dependent upon the industry, the ancillary businesses that supplied those manufacturers, the additional businesses that thrived because of the wages that were earned by those manufacturers. And when the manufacturers looked at it from a very simplistic way, and what I'm talking about, they may have looked at outsourcing from a labor cost only, but no one did the micro and the macro economic model. I don't believe it was fully examined, because when you started displacing those manufacturing, whole communities who were loyal to those companies were now displaced. So now the very survival of those communities who were making choices based upon their loyalty to the brand, those customers were lost in this whole transition. Not as if the plant, say, moved to another community in this nation where maybe they would have been able to resurrect that customer base. They totally lost it as a going concern moving forward. So those displaced customers, and I operated dealerships in those communities, those people that were brand loyal to that manufacturer now were less loyal, and in most cases were angered by the fact that they lost wages and so forth. So, you know, from a pure economic standpoint, it was a bad business model, and that's really where it started.
Kevin, how close are we really to Detroit becoming a ghost town?
You know, people have been examining that for years, and I think it's really close. Now, I believe that those manufacturers maintain headquarters in those in that community in Detroit and those surrounding up in Michigan. However, it's just not going to happen. When you look at labor costs, and again, the automobile manufacturing industry is a global concern now. So now it becomes dollar and cents. That these manufacturers have to look at those wage costs and how it affects their bottom line. So now they're almost forced to displace those manufacturing concerns to other areas where it's just low-cost labor, whether it's India, China, other Asian areas, and so forth. So I see Detroit maybe as a supplier, but not so much as a manufacturer as we know it. Now, there's going to be things that will spring up. Particularly, we're hearing a lot about hybrids, electric vehicles, and those kind of things. And there's a lot of businesses that will be starting up, and they'll be starting up in and around Detroit, but not necessarily near Detroit because of labor costs.
Kevin Kimbrough is our guest. He's an automotive expert. He's owned and operated dealerships, both foreign and domestic, for many years. You can visit him online at kevinkimbrough.com. And that is spelled K-I-M-B-R-O-U-G-H. Kevin, you talk about it being a complex problem, but do try to break it down for us. What actually caused the slide for American automakers?
Well, let's look at it this way. The industry is difficult, and it does start with the manufacturing. So when you look at from a purely manufacturing concern, what it takes to build a vehicle is daunting. It's not like producing business cards or pencils. So the amount of coordination that it takes requires a whole lot of constituents within that whole process. So now when you have an industry that initially produced and manufactured all those components, it became daunting. Now you have to start distributing those vehicles, the quality control, all those kind of things makes for a very complex system. So now you look at it from this way. The manufacturers are dead set on moving vehicles. So you have this complex distribution system with complex laws within each state, because each state, from a dealership and a distribution standpoint, has their own laws. So now you look at it from they have to move iron. So now you get into the form of manufacturers trying to move that iron, as we call it in the industry, mm-hmm. So they have to incentivize it. All these kind of things play into effect, because as a result of economics, as a result of financial situations, the manufacturer is forced to do certain things that normal industries would not have to do. And so it makes for a daunting situation for the manufacturers to do. So we look at industries that maybe from a comparable standpoint, say for instance, I always use General Electric as a company that's kind of reinvented itself. And the auto industry does need to reinvent itself. And I've been arguing this point for years, and a lot of my friends within the industry, particularly on the manufacturer side, we were having these big discussions because they don't see themselves as needing a new vision or new culture, because inside of the big three, they'll argue that they are on the right track. And I believe that they believe that they are, they're trying to set their own course. But history kind of proves that you have to kind of shake up a culture. And using GE as an example, when Jack Welch took over, the company did about $28 billion a year in business. But over the course of the next 15 to 20 years, that company grew to about $410 billion. And the one common denominator that we look at that was radically changed is that the culture changed. And that is what's going to have to happen with the big three.
Kevin Kimbrough is talking cars with us today. He is online at kevinkimbrough.com. You can check out his blog at thatcarguy.com. And we're talking about the meltdown of Motor City, and of course, all manufacturers of automobiles worldwide are feeling the heat. You talk about it being a complex manufacturing issue, Kevin, but you've operated U.S. auto dealerships and owned U.S. auto dealerships as well as imports. And the fact of the matter is American automakers have a huge black eye in public perception. There are an awful lot of folks out there who absolutely believe that American cars are now inferior to those from Japan. What say you?
Well, you know, the manufacturers have brought it on themselves. And going back to my earlier analogy and on the economics, you know, if these manufacturers could sell Granadas and Citations and the like, surely they can sell vehicles. And when you had a loyal customer base, those vehicles were being sold. But as that eroded, the quality issues did become more exposed. But as a result, that quality gap has changed dramatically, and simple searches will determine that. If you could look at, for instance, the National Highway Safety and Transportation Bureau, that'll clearly define where the safety gaps are. The imports are enjoying, I should say, some of the same manufacturing concerns that the domestics have been having now. When you look at the things gone wrong per thousand, which is how the industry is used as a standard to determine the fault rate on these vehicles. But that quality gap has really, really changed, and I think that it's a perception, and again, one of the things that I've been arguing for years is that the big three have done a very poor PR job of explaining that. And much of the other thing is that, you know, the Japanese and Germans, even before this financial crush has come together, they aren't out of the woods either. Toyota had a lot of exposure with the bloated product mix. Particularly, they had a big emphasis on trucks and SUVs. All of these manufacturers have been trying to skirt CAFE issues over the last 20 years. And one of the ways that they've been able to do that is to put SUVs on the market. And what SUVs have done is allowed them to skirt those CAFE rules, because SUVs are classified as trucks. So clearly the Japanese and Germans aren't out of the woods, and as we look as a going concern, they have a lot to do to get their business model back in track too. Now one of the things that's it's a crushing blow to the domestics, and I'm talking about Chevrolet or General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler, is that a lot of the fault of their company has been greatly exposed with the financial crush that's taking a toll on them. And that's taking a toll amongst the manufacturers and along with their dealers and their consumers, because all of these constituents there have a lack of access to credit. A lot of this can be mitigated if they could get a lot of the manufacturers' problems could get mitigated if they had a better access to credit in the terms of loans for dealers, in terms of floor planning. I just wrote about this the other day, is that dealers are having a very difficult time purchasing inventory. They do have some consumers out there that want to purchase cars, but a lot of their floor plan is the line of credit that they use to purchase their vehicles are getting cut and slashed. So a lot of these dealers are going to be out of business here in the next year or so.
So they get hurt coming and going. You mentioned a CAFE rule. What is that?
A CAFE rule is is a rule that has been federally mandated. And I'll say that the current administration is passing a bill that will eliminate a lot of the CAFE standards and putting them back on the individual states. CAFE rules were designed to raise miles per gallon across the board amongst the auto industry in an effort to improve fuel economy. But the CAFE standards were limited in scope, primarily on cars. Trucks were not affected so much. So as a result, that's where the SUV boom came into play. So the manufacturer skirted the CAFE rules by pushing SUVs. You know, one of the things that we talked about, General Motors was on a program years before with the EV1 producing an electrical car. A lot of these technologies have been around for decades, but they just weren't promoted, primarily because the American consumer was saying, hey, listen, we want big cars. So the big three were catering to that need. So, again, when we talk about this from the beginning, of it being a complex issue, there's all kind of factors that have taken its toll here over the last couple of decades to get us to where we are now. One of them is the CAFE rule.
Got it. Kevin Kimbrough is our guest. He's with ThatCardGuy.com and KevinKimbrough.com. He's an auto industry expert. And, Kevin, do you believe that the folks that run the big three are completely out of touch with reality, you know, in terms of what the consumers want? Here in Washington, D.C., you know, those guys got a pretty good drubbing when they all flew in to beg for money on their corporate jets. Do those guys have any clue what Joe and Jane America really want out of their vehicle these days?
Well, you know, I think that they really did, and they had an idea, and they were pushing product to their idea, but they weren't looking at the future and where the market was going. I think that they did lose touch. It is a culture within that manufacturing community amongst dealers, and just like most industries. So people that are running these companies believe that they know what they're doing. You know, I'll take a look at most products are put forth in front of, let's say, consumer groups, groups that help them determine if a design is proper or not. But sometimes those focus groups discussions kind of get overruled by an executive. And that's how you end up coming up with, say, a Pontiac Aztec, because certainly consumers would not have chosen that vehicle design. But so as a result, the executives that make the final decisions do get a little bit out of touch. And I think that ends up happening across the board, because what ends up happening is that people that run companies aren't engaged with the people that are necessarily buying the product. Give you a prime example. One of a great retailer, say a Nordstrom. When you look at their business model, the people that are most important in that organization are the people that come in touch with the customer every day. And I think that a lot of businesses lose sight of that, and that's where I think companies lose their way. As an example, me as a dealer, I was a mid-sized dealer, which means that I was selling vehicles, say, in the middle of the pack. I was on the upper side of that. But the people that get the voice within the manufacturing network are the people that sell the most vehicles. So, say, the top 5% of retailers are the ones that maybe get a voice with the manufacturer. Me, as a mid-level dealer, I don't necessarily get that same voice that the number one dealer in the country gets. So this is where folks get out of touch, because in almost every concern, the people that are selling the bulk of your product are right there in the middle. Much like in our financial system, the biggest consumer spending are in the middle class. And what ends up happening is in almost any organization, the folks right there in the middle don't necessarily get a voice. And those are people who have strong opinions, much like me, and you voice your opinion, but sometimes they get muddled because you're not there at the top. So clearly there is a communication and concern that the manufacturers just did not have with the folks that could express sound, valid judgment on what was going on with the company.
We're talking cars with Kevin Kimbrough from KevinKimbrough.com, and we've got a caller on the line now. Hi, caller, you're on the line to talk cars with Kevin Kimbrough. Hello. Hello, caller. Are you there? All right. Kevin, the cars and trucks made in the USA, you said earlier that, in fact, you don't think they're as inferior as perhaps the reputation would tell, and that gap in quality has closed quite a bit in the last several years. So why aren't they still as good as Japanese and German cars in terms of not only safety but longevity?
Well, again, I think that you've got a clear misconception and a perception problem. I've talked with a friend of mine the other day who had been a long-time import buyer, and they are noticing vehicles, whether it's the new Chevy Malibu, the new Impala, the new Ford Fusion. All these products are clearly as good or even better in a lot of consumer studies than their counterparts within the import community. But when you've got issues like financial concerns, when you've got issues from a perception problem, when you've got issues in which whole communities have been displaced because of the manufacturers moving out of those communities and the manufacturer did not do a good job of replacing that with another growing concern, another growing community by placing a plan in, you've got this real negative impact that has been facing and haunting the manufacturer for years, and they have not made a great leap forward to try to address that. And when you look at perception, that becomes folks' reality.
What about all this talk in the car industry, and certainly it ramped up into high gear last summer when gas prices were around $4 a gallon for most Americans, about hybrids and electric cars? Is the concept of going green in the auto business really going to work? Is that really what the American people want, or is this much ado about nothing?
Well, I think that there's a large constituency out there that wants green vehicles. However, what ended up happening when gasoline dropped, now all of a sudden SUVs became back in vogue. So what I see is going to end up happening is, and this has been a lot of talk within the community and within the auto industry and outside of the auto industry, is that in order to satisfy folks' appetite for green, and in addition to push it to lessen our dependence upon foreign oil, you're going to see a lot of taxing going on. Clearly, there's a lot more oil production than capacity to produce than what we can consume. So that's stabilized oil prices to a large degree. But when you look at our financial crisis, you look at a lot of these different things going on, I think when you look at sin taxes and those kind of things, that gasoline will be taxed to help subsidize the green industry to lessen our dependence upon foreign oil. That's what I see going forward here in the next 2 to 5 years.
Does the technology exist now from a practical standpoint to have efficient battery-operated electric cars that can do what we need them to do?
Absolutely, the technology. Right now what they're doing is testing to make sure that there's longevity. Just when we were talking earlier about a complex issue, it's very difficult to, and takes time to test a product to make sure that it's durable. And what I mean by that is that you produce a battery, and in the ideal conditions, the battery works, but what ends up happening is you have to test a battery in harsh conditions, whether it's extreme heat, extreme cold, and everything in between, whether it's wet and cold, whether it's cold and then hot all of a sudden. You have all these extreme conditions that have to be tested, and those things take time to compile the correct data. So that's where we're at, and there is a big gap between when that technology and a lot of that technology was produced right here in central Indiana, that the manufacturers just put that technology to the side and started focusing back on SUVs. So they've been ramping up at a remarkable pace here in the last 4 to 5 years. And what you'll see here is in the next year, a whole cadre of electric vehicles that'll be on the marketplace. So electric vehicles will be here, will be on market, because there's a lot of people that want it. One of the greatest projects that I've seen, and I haven't fully analyzed it yet, but I really like it, is the Better Place project, which which says that cars are commodities. So they're looking at cars from the standpoint that, much like they're looking at the cell phone industry, that cars as a commodity, you don't necessarily pay full value for the car, but you're paying for the use of the car through recharging your batteries, replacing your batteries, those kind of things. So it's a very interesting business model that leads me to believe that the auto industry going forward as a growing concern is going to be radically different here in the next decade or so.
Very interesting. Kevin Kimbrough is our guest today. He's an automotive expert. You can visit him online at kevinkimbrough.com, and let's see if we can get that caller on the line. Hi, caller, are you there? Ah, we just have a listener, but not not somebody that wants to talk to you, Kevin. I think perhaps like many others, he may be scared of what the future may bring. So if you can, look into your crystal ball as an industry insider and tell us what it's going to look like 1 year from today, specifically with the U.S. auto industry.
Well, when you look at, again, a lot of the problems have been greatly exposed because of the financial crush. But when you look at the auto industry, there's going to be a tremendous revitalization, primarily coming from the company not focusing on, say, all the brands. You already see that with General Motors cutting its ties from Saab. You see that across the board, whether it's them trying to sell Hummer and Ford looking at a buyer for Volvo. These companies are going to be at much smaller capacity and a much smaller business unit than what they once were. General Motors enjoyed its glory days as one of the as the largest company in the world. There's an old saying that as General Motors goes, as the countries go. But moving forward, they're going to be a much smaller business concern. And I think that as I see it, they're going to have to really diversify. So they're not going to be the same company 10 years from now as they are now. It's just even a year from now. Looking forward, they've gotten all this government bailout money, but they're still cutting back employees. A week ago, they got about $13 billion, and they also announced that they're cutting 47,000 people. So you can see that that's going to be radically different. They're going to have to outsource a lot of different things. They're going to have to close a lot more plants. There's a lot of legacy concerns, whether it's health insurance for their retired workers, pension plans, all these kind of things. They're going to have to be dealt with and dealt with really soon. So in the next year, you're going to see radically different companies. And in the next decade, they're going to be totally reinvented from what they once were.
Let's see if we can squeeze a caller in before we wrap up. Hi, you're on the air with Kevin Kimbrough from kevinkimbrough.com. Hello, caller.
Hi, it's Nicolette. I'm in Atlanta. I have
a question, Nicolette,
for Kevin.
Sure.
I just bought a Saab recently, so I wondered what will happen in terms of my warranty and resale and just me owning a Saab. How will that affect me?
Well, I think that a lot of things have happened here recently with Saab, as I just indicated. You've got Saab as an independent unit looking at having to restructure, having to come back in vogue as a independent company away from General Motors and becoming solely dependent upon its own resources. So I would take a step back and look at what happens over the next year. I believe that Saab will be, as a business unit, still a viable company, but it just will be independent of General Motors. So you should be fine. There's going to be a lot of deals moving forward. They're still going to honor your warranty. Again, it just will not be a part of General Motors moving forward.
Nicolette, thanks for the call today, and good luck with your warranty. As we talk to Nicolette and we hear from folks all over the country about this this issue, that's just another example of all the many different arms and legs that the fallout from this automotive meltdown has for everyone. Kevin Kimbrough, thank you so much for taking the time to bring us up to speed. We'd love to have you back on to talk cars again.
Great talking with you, Berg. Thank you.
You bet. And the website, again, where folks can visit you, Kevin, is?
They can see me at thatcarguy.com or kevinkimbrough.com.
And that is K-I-M-B-R-O-U-G-H, kevinkimbrough.com, or thatcarguy.com. I'm Burke Allen on WAMS. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.